Blog Talk Radio.
Peace to the ancestors.
Program with Dr. Mary Lee Live, 400 Years of Entrepreneurship. I'm one of your co-hosts, Dr. Tatum out of California. We got a great lineup tonight, 400 Years of Entrepreneurship. The ambassador for Incredible 400 is Ambassador Nick Cannon. He may be on with us tonight, and his father, Dr. James Cannon. A little bit of that music, a little jazz, a little music in the beginning, Dr. Cornel West. So I'm going to bring you our host for tonight's show, 400 Years. We're going to have Steve Williams. He is president of All Things Juneteenth, doing a national movement across the nation, making a national day of observance in America. He's doing an outstanding job. That'll be one of the guests. But right now, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Mary Lee for Mary Lee Live. God bless.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate that introduction. Welcome, welcome, welcome to all of you tonight. I'm so excited, and I appreciate you all joining us tonight as we continue to commemorate our past 400 years and rewrite history at the same time. So tonight we're talking with Mr. Steve Williams, who is the president of the National Juneteenth. I want to thank you, Mr. Williams, for joining us tonight. And if you want to say hello, it would be greatly appreciated.
Hello, everyone. My name is Steve Williams. I'm the president of the National Juneteenth Observance Foundation. And one of our models is All Things Juneteenth.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. So I am going to, we have also a special guest tonight, and I'm going to ask Mr. Cannon Dr. Cannon to come on introduce our special guest. And also, Mr. Cannon, I still don't see that particular number, so if you can let me know where we go from here. So, Dr. Cannon.
Absolutely, everybody. This is a great night tonight, having Steve Williams on with us tonight to talk about the movement of it's really a movement of people that started many, many years ago, 16, you know, over 200 years ago, y'all, where we really, you know, started this movement. Sometimes it would get fired up. And then.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
Sorry. Okay, yes, I can. No problem.
Yes, sometimes it would spur up all over the nation. Some years people would get excited and celebrate. And then, you know, depending on what was going on in the nation, you know, they would celebrate Juneteenth. You know, it became a holiday down in Texas and a national holiday there, but we wanted to be all over the nation. And what Brother Steve is really pushing forward, we want him to be you know, to tell the story. And so that's the reason we bring him here tonight. We're excited. We're also looking for Nick to come in tonight and share with us on this show as well. So as soon as he drops in, we'll bring him in on the conversation as well, ladies and gentlemen. But this is something that should have really been a national holiday a long time ago, a day of celebration, a commemoration, a long time ago. But with this effort that we have right now, we really, really believe we're going to take this across the finish line and make this happen. And so, Brother Steve, we're excited tonight. Dr. Lee, I'm excited to be a part as well. And we're all going to be a part of this great conversation tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So what is Juneteenth? Juneteenth is an annual observance to commemorate the date that Union Soldiers, United States Colored Troops enforced, and I think that's a very important word, enforced the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, there are more than one definition or explanation for Juneteenth, and so we have a little controversy about it, Granger being the chief of prognosticator in Galveston, but rather the instead of the U.S. Colored Troops. And so we're going to turn to Mr. Steve Williams right now. We want to know, you know, what it is, what's important, what is the truth, and why is it important, and how actually should we celebrate it. Mr. Williams.
Well, thank you very much.
If you can give an introductory, and then we're going to bring on Michael Tynes, who has joined into conversation. So if you can give us an introductory, that'd be great.
So, yes. So let me explain. First thing is Juneteenth, the word is a portmanteau, which is a combination of June and Teenth. And there's several things that have happened throughout June on the 10th. We'll first talk really quickly about the most famous Juneteenth that we call the Texas Juneteenth, right? And that is the Texas, the Juneteenth that is there. But there's several other Juneteenths that have taken place in June. And Juneteenth has come to represent all the other Freedom Days as the U.S. Colored Troops moved west across the landscape of America, bringing freedom with them.
Real quickly, Brother Steve, I'm sorry. I think we do have Nick on. I'm not sure. Nick, hit one on your phone, and Dr. Lee will make that live. We'll know that you're on. We were looking for another number. But hit one on your phone. We'll know that you're live because we want you to have this conversation with Brother Steve because I know with this initiative, we need all hands on deck. And so, Brother Steve, as Nick comes on, just kind of giving the charge of what you want our directives to be, not so much explaining it, but we did want to have you to have that conversation with him. So, Nick, hit one on your phone so we know that you're in.
Hello, Nick. Are you on? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can. Well, hello. Welcome. I certainly do appreciate you joining us. We can hear you.
Oh,
thank
no problem.
You for joining us. And we know you've got a lot to talk about today about you. So welcome, welcome, welcome.
Well, thank you all for having me. And obviously anything my father tells me, I need to be punctual for it. That's the goal. So I'm here because my daddy says so. But other than that, you know, it's a pleasure and a great privilege to have this opportunity to speak on, you know, not only the importance of our history, but how we celebrate it and commemorate it and recognize it, you know, for the future.
Thank you. So what is it to
and
you?
I guess
what is June?
I guess with Brother Steve, with Brother
yeah,
Steve,
my, I would.
Juneteenth has a historical meaning and it has a cultural meaning. And it has an economic meaning. So you've got to look at it like that. And we need to understand the history of it. One of the great things that most people don't know about Juneteenth is that Juneteenth led to Black Wall Street. Direct connection, aligned. Oklahoma Juneteenth led directly to Black Wall Street.
So in order for people to get educated, for other people to become aware of Juneteenth, we are attempting to make it a national day of observance or a holiday. And one of the prongs we need to have that happen is for our petition to go up. Our petition is at Juneteenth.us. And by going to Juneteenth.us and signing this petition, we've got about 1.6 million signatures right now. We're looking to double that by time the bill, which I will talk more about, gets to committee at the end of at the middle of next month. So we're looking to really boost the amount of people that we need while we have our Juneteenth Nation call up the representatives and urge them to co-sponsor the Juneteenth legislation, which is H.R. 1320. So it's a multi-pronged attack that we're using at this time in order to get the Juneteenth holiday passed. One is by educating the legislators. The other is by avid petitioning. And the third prong is by having celebrity endorsements. Bobby Rush, who just won a Grammy, is going to be doing some endorsements for us. He was at our Juneteenth meeting. So that's what we're really looking for.
Well, I think that would be a good opportunity for me to step in and say whatever you need in Juneteenth legislation efforts to share awareness, or even whether it's being able to sign a petition, or, you know, wherever I'm needed. I mean, in the same sense that we've been working with the 400 years legislation push, I would love to be a part of that as well, just because I do know the importance of, you know, not only Juneteenth, but even the ideas of this next generation recognizing what to do with Juneteenth in its future. I mean, the importance of holidays is, you know, the gathering of community, and our community at this time probably needs it more than ever to understand where we came from, what we overcome, and have, you know, the utmost resilience as a people. So my goal would wherever I could jump in, I mean, even just as of recently receiving, you know, a degree in Africana studies and knowing not just the importance of the diaspora, but even a focus on, you know, what we have as African Americans, the understanding that I recently learned of just the ideas of that, you know, it originated in Texas, and, you know, with Texas probably being almost, I mean, Texas, Delaware, and Kentucky were the last three states to, after, you know, before the Emancipation Proclamation, to kind of continue slavery that people celebrated so intensely on June 19th in 1865 to abolish slavery, and it carried on, like you said, onto Black Wall Street, and even to this day when we talk about independence and the importance of freedom in America, that's when it really started for us, and, you know, or at least the attempt for it to start for us, because even in some aspects, you know, a lot of us are still not free. So that's the importance of focusing on how to get free if we know where it originated from.
So the power and the freedom is in Juneteenth. And we say all things Juneteenth is one of our sayings. And in that power, that knowing Juneteenth, by having people go and read Opal Lee's story at Juneteenth.us, push the petition there, right? You can come into an understanding of the fullness of Juneteenth, because over the last 3 years, our education team has really dug in and got to knowing Juneteenth. Mm-hmm. The last people free in America were on June 14th, 1866 in Oklahoma by the Treaty of 1866, which freed the people who were enslaved by the Native American tribes, all five of them. And so that was the last people on this continent to be free. We are very close with the 400-year project. One of our chief contributors to our education committee is Calvin Pearson, who discovered the original documents and started Project 1619, which launched the African-American History Commission, 400-year commission. And the first thing that they did was reach out to us and have a drum along on Juneteenth to kick off that. So we're very tight with them. They have a MOU with us, and we're having them help push the Juneteenth.us petition there on change.org so that we can present those to Congress. Having the day, having the education, the true education, is vitally important to us. We have to get the truth out, and the present education system really isn't, and we know that because we have professors from HBCUs all across the country who now enjoy a different type of freedom working with the National Juneteenth Observance Foundation. No restrictions. Just give me the truth.
And what's really valuable about that is people like Michael, young Michael, who's 21. If Michael, if you could just speak real quickly while Nick is on the line about the subject, why young people your age need to understand Juneteenth and why it's important for y'all to have this to be a national holiday as well.
Yeah, no problem. Firstly, can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yes, we can.
Yeah. Hi, just for everyone on the line, my name is Michael. I primarily operate as an advocate on global African empowerment, and I do so mainly by speaking on African affairs, African people, and African history, trying to work in order to bring about the global independence of our people. And as Mr. Cannon said, something I can speak to is the significance of something like the Juneteenth celebration, but even more so just telling the story of our people in this country. The significance of that on the youth is really a matter of educating our people before they're educated by people outside of our community and lose a connection to our community because, let's say, they're educated in such a way so that they don't really see themselves a part of our community, or they don't really see how their modern predisposition, their racial predisposition, is tied to this country's founding, and they lose a sense of self, so to speak. So I would say the main importance of that on the younger generation on something like this is to have a sense of self that's centered in reality instead of a fiction that someone from outside your community creates.
You know, that's really true. And it's not really so much fiction. What we have termed as subversive indoctrination. Let me give you a really quick example. When we go to school and we are taught history in American history, we are taught that slaves were brought from Africa and slaves were in the South, in the North, and then some slaves ran away. They were escaped runaway slaves. And that's what we're taught in school, right? But that's so very wrong because they didn't bring slaves from Africa. They brought people from Africa and they enslaved them. Okay, and when people ran away, there was people running away from slavery. Because if you're a slave and you run away, you're still a slave. But those are people that ran away. So the subversive indoctrination starts very early on. And our goal is to tell the whole and complete story so that you can have a pride to yourself. When you are taught that you are a slave, you think of your ancestors were slaves and you're descended from those. And those other people who are the majority of the lighter complexion get the same thing. They see us as less, expect us to act as less, and we often see ourselves as less. So we have to start with a really good understanding of our significant contributions to America and the world. And that's one of our primary objectives, awareness, education, socialization.
Thank you so much. I want to thank Nick for joining us and for the time that he had to spare tonight. So I certainly thank you very much, Nick, for joining us. And until next time, we're going to ask, we do have callers on the line. So we're going to ask 269-4211 to let you know that you're live.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you, Brother Nick Cannon. And I think it's important that you launch this format. And I think the whole thing of the Emancipation Proclamation leading to what we call Juneteenth, and the fact that it was said that Africans, but those of, right, because as stated, the Africans saw themselves as prisoners of war. They never considered themselves slaves. They thought slaves was a dirty word to identify them. So, and we said we're descendants of enslaved Africans. But we also have to remember John Horse. John Horse fought the Europeans for 50 years, and I think he moved into Texas in the end, him and that he helped lead from Florida all the way to there. I think that we need to include that. We also need to include that. Remember that in the 1500s, that the the Spaniards brought Africans into Florida before the whole Jamestown 1619. I think that we have to tie that these individuals, the reason why they got them was that they got them from Africa because they, at that time, that they knew about the greatness of the African civilizations and populations, and that they kidnapped these people and brought them here. And I just think that it's important that what you're trying to do, that we have a history that founded America, and that we have to also tie it to the work of Von Werther, that the Unexpected Faces, and Dr. Ivan Van Sertima, that came before Columbus, that we have the African presence here going back 600, 800 BC, and then we have the Folsom people, who are the first people in America who are black-skinned, who are actually the Native Americans, who that the Indians or those Alaskans married into and lost the hippocampal folds or Japanese eyes or Chinese eyes to make the modern-day African, so that we got to clean that up, and that's our history, and that we got to get rid of those who are the Dow Commission of who paid the $5 to be in part, and that you made a very important part that the five civilized tribes, to become civilized, you had the enslaved Africans to be recognized, and they fought against the North to keep the slavery, and that those groups also, those Native Americans, had to be punished because they kept slavery going, and that the 1866 or 1863 treaty said that they actually owed the descendants of Africans reparations. And they received, Indians received reparations every year. They received the lands, they received the casinos, but the Africans still, we haven't received that. And I think once we become a people is unified and that we have a sense of pride identity, as Michael said, then that's important. So one part of Juneteenth is restoring our historical memory and our historical identity, and I think that's what's so critical. That's my opinion. I'd like to hear Nick's opinion and others. Yeah.
Okay, you can go ahead, Mr. Williams.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a curriculum that starts with the Grimaldi that set sail from Africa. We had several of our people that are there in Ghana, in South Africa, who are due Juneteenth, and we have actually done some tracking of that. We've tied it together with Chief Warhorse, who can trace her family and her family history before Columbus in America. So we really do that. We also have among our education staff Dr. Dorsine S. Little. She is the one that is suing the nations for the Indian nations for the reparations. And the fact of the matter is, what they were doing is they paid reparations out to a lot of people, a lot of Native American tribes. It wasn't clear cut. The tribes split in half because half fought for the Confederacy, half fought for the Union. And when they did get the reparations, they did pay out the vast majority of it, but the qualification was that your mom had to be Native American. And so if your dad was African or if your mom was Native American, you were considered a freedman and you were granted all the things under the 1866 treaty. The battle is...
No, Steve.
Yeah. Huh?
If your mom was black and your dad was Native American, you were a freedman.
You were a freedman.
And everybody got 48, and everybody in the family
got 40 acres. If your mom was Native American and your dad was black.
Yeah, well, no, everybody got land.
Everybody got land, right.
The freedmen got 40 acres.
Dorsine, you're on the phone.
I know.
You, my expert.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
The freedmen got 40 acres per person in the family. The people who were by blood, 300 acres per person in the family. And so, and if you were a person by blood, you did not have to pay federal taxes or state taxes. And the freedmen had to pay taxes. So a lot of them lost their land because, you know, they had just come out of slavery. They didn't know what taxes were, and they hadn't built up any kind of income.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of them lost the land because they lost it to people that were coming in, swindling them out of their land, you know, offering them money.
Right.
And also the government, because the native tribes didn't want a lot of the freedmen to remain in the tribe, the government gave the Native American tribes like $300,000, which is like millions of dollars right now.
Mm-hmm.
They gave them $300,000. And if anybody wanted to, if a freedman wanted to leave the tribe, they would pay the freedman money so they could go and get started. And so a lot of the freedmen never got that money. And they sued for their money, but the tribe didn't release the money. Plus, the Chickasaw and the Choctaw were at one point a united tribe. And the Chickasaw cheated the Choctaw out of their portion of the money that they were supposed to give to the freedmen. So the Chickasaw today own the most wealthiest casinos in the United States, probably in the world. The Chickasaw make $1 billion every 3 months, casino. And so they have all kind of benefits for the people by blood. If you're Chickasaw, you get a house. If you're Chickasaw, you get your education. You get a full ride in college. You get computers. You get child care. You get elder care. I mean, the list, the health care, I have a book of the Chickasaw rights, all the benefits they have. It's a thick book.
Can I ask a question?
But let me just mention this one thing, and then I'll turn the floor back over. Each tribe is a sovereign nation. So if you are a freedman from the Chickasaw tribe, you sue the Chickasaw. A lot of people are mixed. They're part Chickasaw and they're part so the freedmen from the Cherokee have won their case. They went to the Supreme Court. So the Cherokee are under orders to put all the freedmen back on the road. The tribe that I'm dealing with is the Chickasaw. So they are not under such order because we're going to have to go through the same court process that the Cherokee went through to get the freedmen back on the roll for the Chickasaw.
Now,
and the same thing is true for the Choctaw, the Seminole, and the Creek. Okay, I'm finished.
Thanks, Dorsey. This is what I mean about the National Juneteenth Observance Foundation. We have experts in all this, all across the country, in every single subject. We have somebody who's a declared expert in it, and we want to know about military history. We've got the best experts in the country about Civil War history, so we tracked what happened in Galveston. So we have built ourselves to be the foundation to educate America about Juneteenth and all things Juneteenth. And so I didn't know Dorsini was on the line. I'm a collector of information. I kind of get it in the right way, but I know I have experts behind me if I want to know what happened or how something is relevant. Doc Myers traveled this country bringing Juneteenth to 45 states in the District of Columbia, and along the way he assembled a family of experts, of people that is incredible, unlike anybody else there. And, you know, he says, here, Steve, take the ball and run. So we're running with it, and so that's what we have here. So many experts that when we come to get to know something, we can just drill down and figure out. I don't know who else is on the line. Carl Adams, Ron Brown, a lot of these guys are great.
Stephanie's
experts.
Here. Stephanie's who? Here.
Stephanie
Bush. Stephanie. Yeah.
Stephanie Bush, we have so many great expert people about Juneteenth, and we have put together so many programs to educate people about Juneteenth and for them to have a pride about themselves that we never had before. I mean, James Brown said say it loud, but, you know, being proud and knowing your history, your heritage, your contribution is really about the self agency of Juneteenth. Is what we really want to get people to understand and know. The self-agency, the self-determination of Juneteenth and being able to move that way forward. So I want to just tell you a couple of things real quick, some real quick Juneteenth dates. June 19th, 1862, Congress outlawed slavery in all the territories. This is called Chapter 111. So that was June 19, 1862. June 19, 1863, the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, they actually enforced the Emancipation Proclamation in Pennsylvania. Also on that day were the first orders received to form the United States Colored Troops. Then we have June 19, 1865, which is when the 29th and the 31st came into Galveston and Granger read General Order Number 3. June 14th was the treaty with the so-called five civilized tribes in Oklahoma was signed, and that was the end of slavery in the nation. On June 19th, 1964, the Civil Rights Act survived the 83-day filibuster in the Senate. And on June 19, 1968, A. Philip Randolph used Juneteenth as a political tool to launch the Poor People's March in Washington, D.C. These are some just a few of the important historical days in Juneteenth history. And when you talk about young people using Juneteenth and rallying behind Black Lives Matter, it would be no different than Barack Obama when he waved the Juneteenth flag and marched in the parades in Chicago before anybody knew who he was. You know, it's always been there. And it's been used to elevate people and causes since its inception. And those are just a few examples.
Thank you.
Steve, could I ask you a question?
Mr. Cannon had a question. I believe Mr. Cannon or someone had asked to have a question.
Yes, the lady could go first. Go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to ask, with all of the wonderful lectures that are being held and all the information, is that being put into an annotated book? How are we going to put all that under one cover? Because that should be called a Juneteenth encyclopedia or something like that, with all of the information that's being given out there. It's, you know, somebody should annotate it, you know. And
so that's what Dr. Taylor's doing. Dr. Charles Taylor, he's writing his new book, Juneteenth, the Celebration of Freedom, and the second revision. He's actually, you know, gleaning information from our committee and our team and using it and expanding it. And we'll see where it's at, and we'll continue to build what we're doing. So, you know, we try to record and transcribe a lot of stuff that we have. And so we definitely are building a bibliography, and everybody is, you know, submitting their stuff online. And so somewhere along the line within the next 6 months or so, somebody's going to have the task of digging into our virtual vault and putting all this stuff together. So that's going to be a job. But, yes, we're keeping recording it.
One of the things we're trying to do with the commission is to get people to write, because y'all know the stories. You can tell the stories. And utilizing tools like Amazon, we don't have to compile a big book. I say nothing over 100 pages. You write on Booker T. Washington. You write on Phyllis Wheatley. You write on Mary McLeod Bethune. And then we do it together. I write my two chapters. You write your two chapters. I say let's write hard, y'all, and tell our stories. We've got tools where we can do our own publishing together, and let all that financing, all that profit go into Juneteenth. I love it. What we can't do alone, we can do it together.
Yeah, you know, we need to solidify a lot of this stuff, and we're doing a lot of work right now. But you know, we have only so many arms and legs that we have as far as getting it done. So we keep the call out for experts to come in and help us with certain things. And I really appreciate the Juneteenth Nation for sticking in there. The one caller talked about John Horse, Juan Caballo. He's known as the Black Moses of Oklahoma. He helped establish the Muskogos in Mexico. And the funny thing about it is that John Horse got them down there in the 1850s, and they had established an area of land just north of where Maximilian was at. So the colored troops that were on their way to the Mexico border to deal with Maximilian, who was trying to bring Texas into the fold with France and get their resources and entice them with the thing that they would support slavery, because France was in the middle of the French Revolution, they ended up being squeezed. And on June 19th, 1866, 1 year after Juneteenth, Maximilian was executed, and he was actually squeezed on one half by the U.S. colored troops and the other half by the Black Muscogos led by John Horse. He was gone by then, but they held the fort down, that part of the land. So the history does tie together.
Thank you. I want to remind our callers that you can tap one on your phone and, with any questions or comments, just tap one on your phone. Go ahead, ma'am.
Oh, I was going to say we also have access to firsthand narratives. We have the slave narratives that was I'm blanking out. But
yeah, it's part of the federal government project where they sit down and talk to the last living slaves and the last living people who were enslaved. And to get their story and their history right there. And we do that. And we actually have Sam Collins. I don't know if Sam is on the phone or not. He's in Galveston. He's a well-known. He's done a lot with the penitentiary slave system down there in Galveston. And he has tracked down people who have tales, family legends, family stories about the Juneteenth. And so we have documented those and recorded those. My grandpa told me this happened when the soldiers came. This is how we found out. It wasn't by a piece of paper, but it was the black men in uniforms with guns that said, hey, you're free. And they didn't hear General Order Number 3. They saw these black men with guns with U.S. on their chest and the uniform, and they knew they were free. That was their freedom. That was their call to freedom. And that we kept hearing that theme over and over again. So that told us that, that was part of the subversion indoctrination, even with Juneteenth, that Granger rode in on a horse. No, Granger got picked up in Mobile, Alabama, and he was hurried down there because the troops that left their commanding officer in Virginia, they're on a boat and they're headed there. They pick up Granger there. And they're trying to get to Mexico. And these brothers are serious. They just got finished capturing General Lee at Appomattox, and now they're on a boat on their way to Mexico to defend America from invasion from France. So the story's much more significant than what it was, and it's much more empowering than what it was, than what we were originally told. So
The narratives I was talking about was the WPA narratives, and they sent out people to record the memories of the slaves. And so there's the slave narratives of the southern plantations, and then there's the slave narratives of the Native Americans. So some of the stories are different because the slave system was different in one part of the country than it is in the other country.
The Cherokee,
their slave system was more similar to the Southerners, because the Cherokees were predominantly mixed race. They were the leaders were offspring of white men and Native American women.
And whereas the Seminole were very, John Horse was Seminole. So
right.
So they were very liberal with their people.
Right, exactly.
They live differently. And because of that liberal, that was the reason why Horse had to end up leaving Oklahoma and going to Mexico, because the Cherokee and the Creek were constantly kidnapping their people.
Well, if I could jump in and ask a question here. My sister, I appreciate your knowledge so very much, particularly on the Indian heritage. And I know we only have a small amount of time left on the show, But, you know, that's valuable to me because my family did come across that plane and that Trail of Tears. But being able to understand the history is lost. But from what I understand, when you said that we did win in that treaty, was that in 2017 when you said we were included? That means we included that if we can prove that we have Indian heritage, that we can be included into the nation and receive the resources. Because my understanding was before they would include us in and they would recognize that we were there and we was around and we were part Indian, but they wasn't allowing Negro Indians to receive the benefits and the resources. But after going to court, I believe as recent as 2017, that was turned over. So all we have to do is prove that we have Indian in our heritage, and we are supposed to be entitled to those reparations?
That's partially right. That, as I've mentioned, this is a sovereign nation we're dealing with. When we're dealing with each tribe, they're sovereign. So the people who are descendants of the Cherokee or that was the slave or members of the family of the Cherokee, they won. All the other four tribes here in Oklahoma, they haven't. The black people who are considered freedmen have not won. But there's more to the story. A lot of people have Indian blood that are black. But if you are not on the Dawes Commission, the Dawes mm-hmm. Commission was set up to decide who was Indian and who was black. And so again, they went the head right went with the women. But some people got on the Dawes Commission because they paid bribes, particularly the white people. Oklahoma is full of what they call $5 Indians. And those are Indians who paid the Dawes Commission to put them on the roll. So the first thing you have to do, and my email is down, my computer's down, something's going on at OU. I get my email and everything to OU, so I haven't been able to use my computer today. But my email address is dslittles@ou.edu.
Okay.
Beautiful.
There D.S. are Little. Three genealogies. dslittles, L-I-T-T-L-E-S,
okay.
@ou.edu. I can get you hooked up with people that are experts on genealogical research, and their specialty is going through those Dawes Commission rolls and finding your ancestors. And when you find your ancestor and they have a roll number, that's your roll number. And so when you have to prove your ancestry to the tribes, so you have to get your birth certificate.
My grandmother was born on a reservation, and this is James Cannon. My grandmother was born on a reservation there in Oklahoma, and she was they were part of that group, but, you know, that left, you know, and for whatever reason, and, you know, but her history was kind of lost. But, you know, the beauty of being able to have conversations like this now is that we could dive back in there and do that research. Even how is that done when from where our slave families were divided? Is it much more difficult? I was told that the Indians kept great records, but the records of the slaves, we may didn't keep that records that well.
The Dawes Commission is key. You have to find mm-hmm. an ancestor on that Dawes Commission.
On the Dawes roll.
That original number is your family roll number. And then you have to, after you get the original member that was on that Dawes Commission roll, then you have to get everybody's birth certificate from that, tracing your lineage all the way from that person on the Dawes roll all the way down to you. And so that's what you present to the tribe when you say, I am a member of this tribe. And I want to be recognized as a
member.
Mm-hmm.
Can you spell that?
D-A-W-E-S.
D-A-W-E-S.
In your best understanding, in your best understanding, why were Indian women called Negroes?
I didn't know that they were called Negroes. If they were black, they as I said, if your mother was, if your great grandmother was black, and your father was Native American, but some of the men, it's a family in Ardmore. I'm from Ardmore, Oklahoma. That's the Chickasaw country. Some of the men who were married to black women, they would go and fight for their children to be put on the roll. So if they fought and they had enough power in that tribe, it's a family called the McGees. And every member of the McGee family has all kind of access to all the full rights. But their grandmother was black, but their Indian grandfather attacked that system and made sure that all of his black children by his black wife got their full rights. So some Native Americans fought that was married to black women. They fought to put their children on the roll. But as a rule, if your mother was black, then they didn't count you as a Native American, or, and they put you on the roll as a freedman. So if you were on the roll as a freedman, you had an F beside your name, you know, and the other role was by blood. So they had two roles. They had the freedman role and they had the by blood. And the by blood, it wasn't that important up until recent times when the Native Americans started getting wealthy off of the casinos, and some of them got wealthy off of oil. In the day when the Native Americans were poor, it wasn't a big deal to a lot of people that they weren't on the roll. But then when the Native Americans got so wealthy and started building houses for their families and building health clinics for the tribe and giving them monthly stipends and all that stuff, then that's when it got important, you know, for your lineage.
I was curious, maybe Michael could share on that too, some insight on that the Indian women were not called squaws. I thought they were called squaws, but somebody brought it to my attention that the males were called Indian, but the females were called Negroes. Michael, was there any insight there that I was missing or anything that you knew on that?
I'm not particularly well-versed on specifically what you mentioned. I know that, you know, persons of American ancestry were at times classified as blacks and Negroes and mulattoes, sometimes on the basis of superficial characteristics like skin color, and other times because, you know, there may have been some known admixture with Africans, but I'm not particularly well versed on, you know, specifically what you mentioned.
Appreciate it.
Well, okay. Squaw was kind of a derogatory term too.
Okay, but weren't the Indians originally enslaved Africans?
Yes, that's how they tried to stay in the South. When the government started trying to take the land away from them in the South, the government said, "Well, if you take on the white man's ways, then you can stay on the land." Because the Indians owned Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama. Louisiana. That was the home of the Indian tribes. And so when the America started expanding west, they started eyeing this land, this rich, fertile land in the South. And so they immediately started trying to take the land away from the Native American tribes. So they told the Native Americans, if you would adopt the man, then you can keep your land. So that's why the Native Americans started having plantations and enslaving black people, because they were imitating the white men in the hopes of keeping their land. And they signed treaties. The United States government has broken every treaty that they wrote with the Indian tribes. The Indian tribes never broke a treaty. The government always broke a treaty. And so they eventually rounded up and the Trail of Tears was actually named by the Cherokee, but every tribe suffered the Trail of Tears, and every tribe arrived on average with a third of the people who had left from their original home. That's how many people died, because they would make them leave in the heat of the summer or in the dead of winter. And most of them didn't have the horses or wagons and things like that, so they walked from Georgia and Alabama and Florida. They walked to Oklahoma.
Yeah. And how you doing? I'm Dr. Tatum, part of the Oklahoma Tatums. They were hooked up with the Choctaw Indians. Do you have any information for the Tatum, Oklahoma? I'm part of that family heritage.
The Choctaw was a part of the Chickasaw. Yeah, the Choctaw, their headquarters is in the eastern part of Oklahoma, in Hugo and Ron Ada in that area. The Chickasaw is in the southwest central part. So Tatum has not only Choctaw Indians, they also have Chickasaw, predominantly Chickasaw. But you had a lot of people from the South coming to Tatum that were not Native Americans, but they may have passed when Native Americans got here. I think I told you last week that there was a plantation owner that had about 10 or 11 girls by a slave woman, an enslaved woman, and he wanted to protect his daughters, so he put his daughters in a wagon and sent them to Tatum's, because a lot of people were coming to Oklahoma because they had this land here that they could get through the land runs, or they could come in and buy land. My grandfather bought 160 acres, and I think he paid a nickel or a dime per acre for his 160 acres. So the people from the South were still under such fear of their lives that they were flocking from the South. Have any of you seen the trains in India when people are hanging off the side of the trains and riding on the top of the trains in India today?
Yes.
In the late 1800s and early 1900s, that's the way the trains looked coming into Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. You had black folks hanging. I had a picture of it. I can't find it anymore. But there were pictures of black people hanging on the side of the trains and on the side.
So, Dr. Little, we're working on a brief document that shows the connection between Juneteenth and Black Wall Street. And there's a timeline that goes along there. And we hope to have it together shortly. Dr. Little's doing a lot of things, but I hope we can have it together pretty shortly and be able to shed a lot of light on the importance of the Oklahoma story.
Okay, we want to bring in our callers as well. We want to ask 661-7000. You are live for your question or comment.
Erico
6611.
Okay.
269-4211.
Erico 269-4211. Hello.
Yes, we can
hear
you.
When you talk about the Chickasaw, a lot of them are based out of Mississippi, but also to be civilized, you kind of hinted to it that you had to align yourself with Europeans, and that the Native Americans, some of them were the ones who enslaved the Africans, also were the bounty hunters who would track down the Africans. And as you said, that the treaties is your highest law in the land, and that there was supposed to be a treaty of the Native Americans compensating the descendants of enslaved Africans, and that the Africans hated to be called slaves. I know they used the term by Dr. Robinson that they called themselves prisoners of war. They wrote the Negro spirituals, "Before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave," that they were very against that. And that also that Andrew Jackson, you know, went and took their land and moved them from, you know, from Florida all the way to Oklahoma. And you mentioned John Horse and Morning Dew, which, you know, led to the Indian, the African Indian Seminole Wars. There was, you know, conflict between the African and the Indian, and there was unity between the African and Indian. And then also the reading, I see that we did the Emancipation Proclamation, but it was the blacks pushing the Emancipation towards the north, because Lincoln did not free the northern slaves. They were still under bondage, and that so I have that issue that they were still under bondage, and that then next that the whole thing about not being a slave and going with the amendment saying 13 minutes saying that you can be a slave again if you're in the prison system. So my point to the speakers is that, okay, so one, what is this that it was really the Emancipation going from Texas, going back across towards the north, and making people free, because that's when they had the mindset to enforce the government to do right. And second was that the indebtedness still owed to the descendants of Africans, according to that Indian treaty, I think, in 1866-1863. That's my questions.
So what I would say is the first thing you have to understand is that is a misconception about Lincoln, okay? Lincoln's progressive learning to free people from the evils of slavery took most of his life, okay? The first person he freed was a lady by the name of Nance Wegen Cosley in 1841, 20 years before he was president. Right? He freed Nance Cosley in Illinois. He saw her case. He fought it all the way to the Supreme Court, freed her and her two sons. Okay? Lincoln was constantly pushing for legislation to free people from the evils of slavery. He freed some 20, 30 cases on his way before he became a politician. Okay? And then you look at the progressive of his issues of dealing with Congress, trying to get them to move and deal with slavery. The Emancipation Proclamation was just a general order. It was an executive order, and it was designed to put the people on notice, to rebellious states, that we are going to confiscate your property. Where did he get that from? Well, he got that from earlier in the year, the Second Confiscation Act. Okay, the Second Confiscation Act was formed because of three men who had freed themselves because they refused to fight for the Confederacy or provide them support. So they rode to the same place where Isabella and William got off in 1619, Point Comfort, Fort Monroe. And the general there took them in and says, "Hey, listen, you don't have to go back. When the owner came and got them, you can't claim them. We're claiming them as contraband of war." This was after Congress already banned slavery, and Lincoln forced them to ban slavery and end slavery in the territories. And before that, Lincoln passed legislation freeing the people in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, finding that loophole. So the progression was all the way going forward. The Emancipation Proclamation sounds good because it rhymes, but it didn't do anything. What really made something significant was that was putting you on notice, we're confiscating your property, okay? We're confiscating your property. We're going to build an army. We're going to take your stuff from you. The 13th Amendment passed later on was really a significant thing that had to be ratified. Now, of course, they had to do that because somebody would have found a loophole to continue the chaos. But because he passed the 13th Amendment and got it there, that's when those other people said, well, that's enough of that. We got to shoot him because he wants to make them citizens and give them voting rights. So the progressive nature of Lincoln's legislation is something that's highly misunderstood and underestimated by the common person. I used to myself before a few years ago. I started really studying what he was doing and how it was done. And so, and with the advent of knowing that he was fighting cases before he was a politician, when he was just a lawyer, sheds a whole new light on it. Most people don't know that he was doing that. And a side note is that we talk about our hero right now for Juneteenth is Private William Cosley. Private William Cosley was freed by Abraham Lincoln when he was 10 months old. Then him and his three brothers-in-law joined the Illinois 29th, the U.S. Colored Troops, to go free the rest of the black people in America. That's self-agency. Okay, that's self-agency.
Okay, 2 points. One, Lincoln's statement himself quoted is that if I can maintain slavery and save the Union, I would. And the second point was that the economic base, the work base, the workhorse base of the factory for the South was the enslaved African doing all the work. And by freeing them, you actually shut down the economy. So, and there was an understanding there was pushing for the Emancipation Proclamation. But so it's interesting what you said, that Lincoln was trying to save the Union, and he offered clauses to allow those in the South who were to join the Union to still hold on to their slaves.
Michael, can you jump in here and make sense of both of those sides?
So, but he gave only part of the quote. So if he gave only part of the quote that Lincoln did, you only get part of the truth. And the quote that Lincoln said, if I could save the Union without freeing the slave, I would do it. If I could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. If I could save the Union by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would do that. I'm trying to save the Union. That was his first thing. So take the whole quote. Lincoln's thing was to save the Union. Slavery was an issue to be dealt with, but he had a history of freeing people from slavery. But at a certain point, he realized that America was bigger as a whole from that. You got to understand that some white people were still shell-shocked from the slaves who escaped during the Revolutionary War and killed up a bunch of black people. You don't know about that. They joined the British. They said, hey, we're out of here. We're going to the British, right? And they ended up fighting and shooting and killing up a whole bunch of white people, right, for the British, but the British lost the war. So they had to go someplace else. They moved up into Canada and Nova Scotia. So that was the shell shock that was still part of what was going on there.
The most profound statement I'm going to make.
The economic part? Oh, well, the economic part was, of course, there. That's where 40 acres and the mule came from. He's like, hey, we got to debase and pull the economic engine out from under them. Because they had decided, they said, we had decided to call our Negroes slaves and treat them as property, as well as a right, was something that was not really acceptable by the vast majority of the people in the Union, so especially in the North.
They're doing a complete history of Abraham Lincoln right now on HBO. If you look at it, you get a whole different perspective of Lincoln. So I think this is the fourth or fifth week the series is on. It might be because he was
I couldn't trust anything coming out of Hollywood, so especially HBO.
Well, okay. Well, anyway, I found it pretty informative and amazing. But
okay.
Anyway, but this is a statement I'm going to make that I think is the most profound statement I'm going to make tonight.
Okay.
The Civil
okay.
War has never ended. The Civil War has never ended. That's what January the 6th means. That's Civil War. That's what revocation of the voting, with the 400 and something bills they got in all these states now of trying to replicate the voting rights of black people. That's the Civil War. The Civil War is continuing. And the people that live in the South, particularly in Virginia, around Richmond and those areas, every month they have a reenactment, Civil War, and the reenactment is always of the wars that the South was winning. Up until 1863, the South was winning the Civil War. And they're still fighting that war in their mind, and they're not going to win until they can get their slaves back. So this is what all of this
politics. Well, you know, I would disagree with that, because I know several sons of the Confederates. I've been dealing with them for 20 years because I've been here in Virginia. You know, and they have a different take on what they would do for that. But then the sons of Confederates weren't the ones storming the Capitol. So, but I would say that they have a different perspective on it, and their perspective is more about their keeping their heritage, not so much about some of the other things that people say.
But their heritage is being owners of slaves. Every white person
that's part of their heritage, but that wasn't, as they would say, discovered as a major part of their heritage. Now, I would just say that.
It is not a part of their heritage, because only about 10 to 20% of the South were slave owners.
Right.
Everybody else was poor. They're going around saying that they're
exactly. That's what the Southern Confederates would tell you. You know, they would tell you that. I mean, I had a computer shop in a little town called Leesburg, Virginia, right on the border. Leesburg. You're right there, right? And my shop, and I was the best computer store written up everywhere. And I remember one day the current Attorney General, Mark Herring, had just left my store and told some of his friends to come see me. And this guy came up in the truck with a Confederate flag, jumped out the truck, had on his jacket, his shirt, the Sons of the Confederate, picked up his computer and brought it to my store. Set it down right there in the front. And me and Rob ended up being really good friends. I went to his house several times. It was quite an experience.
major question. Should we use the Juneteenth to try to push for the African to be considered a full human being? That issue has never been addressed. And also, because we have to look at the Dred Scott decision that's still on the record books, should we use this to give us full humanship? Because we had Malcolm X had a human rights movement, and initially came with the civil rights, and he moved to human rights. Should we now use Juneteenth to push the human rights agenda for the African-American, because everybody's trying to focus on the Hispanics, Native Americans, and other groups? Should we now be considered full human beings by this government, by the Constitution, and modifying that 13th Amendment and striking down the Dred Scott decision, where white man doesn't have that black men don't have any rights that a white man is bound to respect? Should we use Juneteenth to help push that agenda?
You don't have a seat.
Hold on a second.
This is real. It makes you break out. Okay, Michael?
I'm here. So, Juneteenth has many iterations, and that's part of the education part. The key thing about Juneteenth is getting the acknowledgement necessary in order to move forward in this country. And whether it's some or vast majority of them, to get that acknowledgement is the first thing we have to do. And also addressing those disparities like that. Full citizenship, as in if this is the operating constitution that we're working with or the inoperative constitution that we're referring to, that's a whole nother discussion what it has to go into. To modify the 13th Amendment to make sure that when people go to prison, they can still work or be put to use is something that has been discussed and been rewritten. But the first thing we have to do really to keep our focus is, and our focus as the Juneteenth Nation, is to first get the acknowledgement of, you know, even though people might say differently, of the end of chattel slavery in America. Okay, and to teach that's the first thing we've got to go. And so before you can say whether we're full human or not, that's part of the first coming. I said they still teach in school that we're slaves. your school system. You go to your school system and look at that book. They don't refer to you as enslaved people. That's semantics, and you're slaves. I mean, you're only three-fifths of a person. You're less than human. That's taught every day in every classroom across America right now. So we want to start someplace. We start right there. I did it to the Virginia Education Commission, and they all set their flag. They sent me the program because my son goes to school here. And I said, this is all crazy. I sent them an email back. They asked me to talk. I happened to send it from my Juneteenth address. So I guess they, you know, paid attention to it. But I told them that, you know, you got to throw this in the garbage can. So before we get that high level, we got to start the foundation. We got to start with the young people coming up right now and then get them to the point where they can understand that. So I'm not trying to put the cart before the horse. All that is very important. We need to get to there. But the place we got to start at right now is the acknowledgement and then get that education in there to these people. It's critically important.
So you know, we're not free until then, until we understand
right.
enough.
When you open up a textbook and they say they brought people from Africa and enslaved them, that's the when you know we're making some real traction. Okay, and they weren't slaves. Like Africa was breeding slaves. Hey, there's slaves over here. You know, and that's what our kids are taught. That's why they don't like themselves. That's why we don't love ourselves, because when you go to the school, you're taught that you're something out the gate, less than human. All right, Juneteenthers in the 1860s, they didn't have that. They didn't have the Jim Crow effect upon them, so they were able to go out and get things done. You know, they were allowed to be self-determination, self-sufficient. They took just a few of the families they had. They built the town. They built the economy. You know, the first thing that the group did down in Galveston 5-6 years later is they pulled all their money together and bought a park and some land so they could celebrate Juneteenth without being harassed. That's self-sufficiency. So we have to get our people back to there. A. Philip Randolph said there's no reserved seats at the banquet table of nature, and that is true. So we have to get in there and change those things. But as far as first things first, we got to start with the awareness and then the education.
Okay, then what is next?
Then socialization.
Pardon me?
As in socialization, as in
okay.
elementary school, teaching people how to live with each other and get along, how to
okay.
be social. Socialization.
Are you saying to teach blacks how to get along with blacks and get rid of the deprogramming that blacks always don't trust blacks, don't want to work with blacks?
I'm saying black people get along with black people. Black people get along with white people. We got to live in this country together. If you got to
get along with everybody else.
Socialization.
Get along with everyone, not just getting along with each other first.
Right. You know, I had the discussion, the guy said, well, black people are shooting each other. That's PTSD from slavery. Stop being an idiot. You know, that's what's going on. That's the effects of slavery in those neighborhoods. That's the drizzle down effect of slavery and the constant bombarding of Jim Crow and the subversive actions of the government, you know, with the welfare state. It's all compounding there. That's why we have this problem. And we don't know who we are. And when you do go to school, you're taught, why would you want to go to school and pay attention? Somebody tells you your ancestors had no contributions and they were all slaves growing up in Africa. That's not a good look. Would that make anybody feel good about themselves? Would that make the other side
feel
good about you?
Is it important that socialization start with us, with one another, and concentrate,
yeah.
you know, take it step by step, concentrate on, okay, how do we get along as a people? How do we collaborate in businesses? How do we work together? That's what we don't know. That's what we don't do in a good way.
I think, too.
Yeah,
I think
that's a great thing about Juneteenth.
I think what the young people are concerned, when they look at the history, and they look at what has taken place. I think the only thing that young people are upset about, particularly, is the fact that there's still a $20 trillion debt that's owed. You know, we could talk about the history. We could get a lot of things. But that's, I mean, we've proven that we can do everything else. We could be great in every sphere of life, and we've proven it. We started at the bottom, and we've come to the top. But the only thing, and other ethnic groups would never respect Negro people until we get that $20 trillion debt that's owed to us by America, not by another nation, by this nation where we've worked. I think the most paramount thing we should be focusing on is collectively, how do we say to America, pay us and our children at once? And what we're talking about is back pay. So I think step number one, let's get Juneteenth to be a federal holiday. And then number two, let's massively, collectively march in the streets to the courthouse. It's an intellectual conversation. They know they owe us, so it's not an emotional conversation. When our best litigators should be able to take the United Nations report and all of the other reports of what took place and make sure that the trillions of dollars that's owed to the Afro-American Negro people in America, we should be the richest people in America, if not the second richest people in the world, the Negro people in America, we really should.
So how's that look, Dr. Tatum? How does the payout look to you? What does that look like?
How would that look? That would look like $1 trillion a year for the next 20 years. And you pay out the students when they finish high school. If they got Negro in their blood, they would get $250,000 at high school graduation. When they finish college, they would get their second $250,000. That would strengthen the black colleges, and that would make the dropout rate in high school disappear, because every black mother is going to make sure her son is there to graduate to get his $250,000. Graduation should mean something. That's how we should pay it out. We can raise $1 trillion a year for 20 years and settle this debt.
That sounds like not a bad, pretty bad option. If we get the educated people there and we get the mindset right, yeah.
I think we can create two state lotteries to help jumpstart the class action pool. So that we get 100% of that state lottery in each state and let that profit go to pay reparations. If I say cannabis, if we legalize it, give us 50% of the profit for the next 100 years. We don't want to grow it. We don't want to touch it. We don't want it to be a tax. We want 50% of every medical invention that got cannabis in it. I think we worked the grounds enough. I think those 120 companies that's complicit in slavery, they should have to pay yearly into a pool to make sure that we get paid. We could jumpstart it. A federal lottery where the whole world can play, we could raise $1 trillion a year to pay this debt.
Okay.
Dr. Lee.
That looks pretty.
I totally agree. And I'm concerned about the order, you know, how do we approach all of this? So I love the idea of the reparations. So do we work on getting along with one another simultaneously with devising and, preventing plans for reparations legally? So I feel that getting along with one another will help to lead to the self-sufficiency.
You're right.
You see. I think
the reparations component, because if we can really cure the dropout rate in our high schools, what moves us as adults? Money. But if every one of these young men know he got $250,000 at graduation, who's going to talk him into dropping out of high school? We could cure the dropout rate by putting the reparations out there as the proper, you know, it's back pay. They shouldn't have to go to school to get it, but it's something that they deserve. It's owed to them, but to say we're not going to give ignorant people hundreds of thousands of dollars. We want you to go to college. You finish college and you get your second of 250. We can pay the elderly people off with that first $1 trillion, that first half of that first $500 billion, and then you pay the high school students off, and eventually, y'all, I think this debt could be. When we look at our young people, they love America. They love the opportunities that are here. But they know that to finish high school broke, finish college broke, when their ancestors have worked 265 years, I think that they will never respect us as middle adults if we don't get that $20 trillion for our grandchildren.
And I also I just want to inject this really quick. I think it's important that as we move towards, you know, reparations, socialization, self-sufficiency, that and you also stated it, everyone has stated it earlier, that we need to know who we are. And then there is a genealogy bank or service that Mrs. Little talked about. Dr. Little talked about earlier. And so I strongly feel that part of the reparations should include free genealogy services for each and every single one of us to know who we are. Because personally, I don't feel that, you know, saying, okay, we know that we're Africans, but what tribe? Or you know what part? So they know who they are. They can refer to themselves as whomever they are, from India, from, you know, so Italian and all. But we can't. So what do you think about that being part of also reparations? I mean, for every single one of us.
That would be a filtering point. I see the big deal with that. We have to actually have that in place in order to qualify the people to make sure that there aren't like what's that lady's name, Dozier, that was up in Washington who pretended to be black. What was her name?
Mm-hmm.
We have to have some type of vetting process to make sure you're a descendant, you're a recipient of the 13th Amendment. That is something that has to be built into it, because with that type of resources, it's going to take a lot. I think that to get that mission done and to get in there, it's going to take. The Congressional Budget Office has already come up with a number for what they owe black people in slavery. They came up with that number
in addition to identifying who we are, because the first thing that they did when we were enslaved was to strip us of our identity. They need to give it back to us.
But in order
we
to
couldn't
get,
even
in
speak
order
in, we couldn't even speak in our own tongue. So we totally forgot.
But in order to obtain the reparations, what's important here. And I like my sister, I don't remember her name, that was sharing about the genealogy. If my understanding is that Barack Obama signed legislation for Negroes to be moved off of birth certificates. So let's say if the Indian community was going to get reparations based on them proving what tribe they came from, If they just all was American Indians, then it would be hard to find which ones were Cherokee. And so the same thing with Afro-American people, not going so much backwards to find out what tribe we come from to Africa, but to understand what America owes the Negro people in America. If they take Negro off of the birth certificate retrospectively, going all the way back, is there any other way to determine who is the ancestor of a slave here in America if it's not to find out if you were called Negro? That's my question. Far as you know, have they taken that off birth certificates? And if so, would that make it more difficult to trace your ancestry if they've taken it off the birth certificate, or can we rely on DNA testing?
Well, just Negro alone wouldn't qualify you. The Negro alone just wouldn't qualify you as being a slave or being enslaved, right? A vast majority of people, they have records, tax records and tax rolls and inventories of their slave, of their enslaved people and what their names were, what their value were, when they were brought in. So it would take a lot of different resources to combine that together to track that down, not just birth certificates, because a lot of people didn't have birth certificates. Listen, Frederick Douglass didn't know when he was born. He just picked a day. I'll pick this day. You know,
so then DNA, Dr. Little comment on this? Or is she gone? She's not with us.
Louis Gates. Am I on or not?
Yes, you are.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we
Henry can. Louis Gates, every week he traces people's ancestry all the way back to Africa. So the DNA does have markers now that tells you what tribe you belong to in Africa. So DNA has been refined every.
But that doesn't address the issue of enslaved people. So you've got to have something to say, my family was enslaved by this person. Like in Georgia, we've got a group of people who are suing the state government for their property and their land back for reparations because they're able to got a paper trail and they show where the state has actually stolen the land from them, right? So in order to institute reparations, we need to be, because a lot of people are going to be claiming that they were enslaved people.
Well, the genealogy.
Well, we know that all ancestors were enslaved people, and we're the descendants.
So wouldn't it be
better?
Not every black person in America was enslaved. A lot of people that were not slaves.
Right. There's a lot of people
that
were not enslaved.
I know that there weren't, but descendants of. How about descendants of? I know everyone wasn't.
That comes down to creating something similar to the Dawes rules, to the Dawes Commission. You got to be able to figure out who really was descended from an enslaved family. You know, I got some people who like they've been here for 200 years and their family was never enslaved. You know.
But I was more or less referring to restoring the sense of pride in knowing who we are. That's really what when we start to socialize, it's a restored of dignity, of self-worth, pride in knowing who we are, what our ancestries have accomplished, because we didn't start from the bottom. We never started from the bottom.
How would you find out when they were your DNA and you find out you're 30% Chinese and 20% Native American?
Well, you'd have to do the African ancestry DNA. Literally takes identifying your tribe.
Be smiling.
Even though I've seen Dr. Louis Gates do testing every week, I also seen something very controversial where he was saying that for people to think that you could take saliva and find out from your saliva what tribe you come from in Africa, I also seen him say that's preposterous. And whether he's just doing mm-hmm. that for productions or ratings, I'm not sure. But the question would be, if my grandmother was a Negro and her grandmother was a Negro, and they are owed trillions of dollars, if they change my grandmother's birth certificate just to an American citizen, and then I or my grandchildren come back to find out what's owed to the Negro people of my grandmother, if they've purposely changed all of the birth certificates of Negro people to put American or Afro-American on there, then that would be muddying the water. It would be like changing a football team's name over and over and over to eventually there's no debt that's owed because you changed the name. You cannot trace it. If we did not put Negro on our census 2020, then I think it's going to be impossible if they've erased Negro off our retrospectively. From my understanding, you have to now get a court order from a judge to get original birth certificate with Negro on it. If that's the case, then it's going to make it impossible to trace back to find out who was descendant.
Well, no, Dr. Cannon, it won't make it impossible because owners, people who, the slave owners, people who own these people, they kept records. They kept records, a lot of records. And you can,
yeah,
the records are still there.
If they muddy the water in the middle and they change it in the middle, then how, if they change all the
No. If you go back and you say your father was bought for XYZ and your mom was bought for XYZ, right? You know that they were bought and they were enslaved right there, right? And they were caught through the rolls. There's an audit trail that's there. They can try to muddy the water, but there's still an audit trail that's there. And that's what it's going to take in order to filter that out, you know.
And there's too much genealogical research going on right now for them
mm-hmm.
to wipe out all the birth certificates. I mean, that would be destroying a whole industry.
Right.
And that's one thing you can do if you want to find out your ancestral line. is to invest in Ancestry.com or some of the genealogical research. But as far as there's a lot of online classes that teach you to do your own genealogical research. And you can do as much research as you can with public records. And
mm-hmm.
as far as the plantations are concerned, Steve is right. I found my grandfather my great grandfather was 12 years old in 1850. He was a mulatto. He was a plantation owner's son. He was listed as property at 12 years old on the census. So they kept kept records of their property. You know,
yeah, they
so
did.
They're not going to wipe all of those birth certificates and records that are at the Library of Congress. The genealogist, we have a genealogist with the Choctaw tribe. She lives in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. She's up there all the time doing research.
They kept those records for insurance purposes as well, because
help me
as
right.
property. And when a slave would run, when an enslaved person would run away or they lose them, then they get paid by the insurance. But we still want to acknowledge, our time is kind of winding up down. We want to acknowledge another caller, our audience, air code 313-3773. You are live.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay. Hi. This is Dr. Davis in Detroit, Michigan. Wonderful discussion. And it's like right when I was going to ask about that DNA tracing, and then you started talking about it. I think that is a tremendous aspect that we should really look at and really delve into, because with, like you said, you go to Ancestry.com, and you give your DNA, and they'll pop up and say, hey, this person that gave their DNA, you're at least a cousin or a second cousin. And the key with that is getting as many people as you can to give their DNA. And so if you have people that already have lined up and know their ancestry and know they have the roots, from coming from Africa, and they have their DNA in there, the more African-Americans that we can actually get to actually submit their DNA, and we coordinate it ourselves, you can actually get that lineage. You can actually show where we originally came from, and the ones that were listed in the documents as being prophets. And I think it's important to actually have that infrastructure in place before we get to the place, or do it synonymously with the reparations. Because
right.
Once that's in place, before the reparations come, and then when the reparations come, it's like, hey, well, here they are. We have however many millions of African Americans that have a lineage already established. And so I think it's good to actually work on that leg at the same time that you're doing reparations. And I like the ideas in terms of reparations. I look at, even here in the state of Michigan, we have we look at the lottery, and they say, hey, this many billions of dollars goes towards education from the lottery. And it's like, man, if we set something like that up where we have a national lottery, and so everyone's putting in a certain amount, and this is going towards the reparation pool, we probably could get a significant, hundreds of billions of dollars that is coming on a continuous basis. So that seems very feasible and plausible, but I think it's important to set up that DNA tracing so we know who we're dealing with and how many people we're dealing with, and then that'll be in conjunction with the reparations. But tremendous conversation. I love it.
Has anybody seen the reparations program at George Washington, at Georgetown University? Does anybody know about the reparations program at Georgetown?
No.
But this is Dr. Thomas. I need you to know that in Utah, I've been there. There's a government, affiliation between the Mormons and the United States government census, and that they keep all the census records for the United States as part of their religion. I've been there. I traced my family back to 1710. There's a library you can go in there, and you only have to pay to print up your stuff. And they work with the government. So every single record that you have at the Library of Congress is also in the city of Utah, and it's run by the Mormons because they were using that to try to track the genealogy of their people. So that's available to anyone, and then you can pay for it otherwise. But those records are kept. They're considered treasure documents. And remember that it's easy to trace the African American, because once they instituted the whole Social Security number, that was even for the property, which is the African American, and that is legal tenure that represents the wealth of the United States. So you do have your Social Security number as a basis that you are an African or of African descent. You also have the census at the Library of Congress, and also at the in Utah, in the Library of Utah, that keeps the genealogy research for the United States. So you have access to be able to trace that.
And they are
so that's the reason why I asked the question. Have you seen, they have a reparations program at Georgetown University. If your parents, if you are a descendant of the people who built Georgetown, you get a free ride, free education, housing.
Almost every university has that. That's called a legacy program.
The legacy program.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, I know that Georgetown just instituted their program about 4 years ago, and it's for people who are descendants of enslaved people that helped build that university and program there, the campus.
Yeah, Harvard has it, Yale, all of those.
Thank you. We want to go to caller 910-1099. You're live.
Yes.
Code 910.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
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 I think one other thing that we need to definitely take into consideration before reparations is financial literacy. We don't want to be in a position where we're giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to individuals that don't know how to handle money. That's the issue now with a lot of the things that happen today in our younger generations where they go out and get their hands on all this money and do stupid stuff with it. So we need to teach financial literacy for them in our early education programs, just like other races do as well.
So that's what I was going to, that's the point I was going to make earlier. You know what's the one difference between us and every other group of people is we don't have any cooperative economic program. We don't have a TANDIS. It's not part of our culture. We don't do any
it. It is a part of our culture, Steve. Black Wall Street.
But Black Wall Street wasn't cooperative economics. It wasn't a TANDIS. It wasn't a TANDIS in a traditional sort like you have right now between Asian communities, Latino communities, or even Somalian communities. They come together and they put together.
We don't have a problem. We have the opportunity.
Not taught in elementary or high school either.
Right.
But see, that's the key.
But these cultures, they go they'll put 10 or 15 people together and they'll pull their money together as a group. And then
they'll award the pot to one another
in order to do something. They'll stack themselves together and build a business and everybody support that business. And then they'll take it out and the next person will get their turn and everybody supports them. It's many different variations of the tangents there. As a whole, we don't, that's part of getting along. We can't get along in general long enough together to share money with each other.
That's not Black Wall Street then.
That's not now. We have not taken those lessons and applied them today. Today we are dysfunctional people when it comes to economics.
We are dysfunctional today, but we have a history. What I'm saying is that we have not always been a divided nation or people that don't work like together. Black Wall Street was not an anomaly. If you went to any town of any size, you had a black part of town.
Right.
You had business people. You had a thriving industry because they couldn't shop where they wanted to shop.
But you had people who were entrepreneurs.
People were entrepreneurs,
but that, Dorstein, is not a TANDIS. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a TANDIS, which is when groups of people come together with a common goal, small groups of people. Right, and they do that constantly. When you show up, I was into the Somalian community really in depth, right? And the Somalian community, Orthodox Muslims, they don't pay banks, they don't do anything like that, right? But they circle their money amongst themselves. They keep their money amongst themselves. One guy will go out and work, and he'll get with a group of people, and he'll take half of his paycheck and give it to them. Half his paycheck and he'll work. He'll live off half of it. When it comes his turn, he's got a house and a car. He bought a house and a car.
The only people who don't do that is us.
But there was a time that we did that. I'm not going to be critical because it takes a format.
It's a model. But you can deviate from the model, and I'm saying that
that's the reason why we do this.
It was not the exact model, but they supported each other. The first thing that black people did when people came to Oklahoma and formed a town, the first thing they did was they pooled their money and built a school. Mm-hmm. So, right. So that was putting all their capital together because they realized education was important. And then they would reach
that's
back
why we
and
use
bring
Oklahoma. That's why we use it, Dorsey. That's why I'm using Oklahoma as a model, because of that history. That was history. But presently where we're at right now is the situation we're dealing with. They don't know that history. The vast majority of people, we don't know that history, and we don't know that part of our history. We're in a dysfunctional state right now where we don't get along and where we don't trust each other with money.
Let me ask one question. And okay, if other ethnic groups had as many churches, organizations as we have, if they had as many historical black colleges as already set up across the country, I say we already have the infrastructure set up to do what we need to do. We got many black churches and many black colleges. We need to re-strengthen the black churches the black colleges, because that's where our heritage is. If other ethnic groups had as many historical black institutions like we have, okay, we just got to start pulling back together. I remember my grandmother in those churches pulling their monies and coins together for mission, pulling it together to send people. So we know how to pull together. Like the young lady was saying, we've just been sidetracked. We begin to love everybody else's grass, and we ain't taking care of our own grass. We ain't building our own college. I think every young man, every young person should do their undergrad at a historical black college, and then go get your master's degree wherever you want.
It's not what
that historical black college can do for you, but it's what you can do for that historical black college. You owe the black college to at least do your undergrad there and then go off to all the other institutions.
And our theme for Juneteenth this year is prosperity through Juneteenth, physical, mental, physical, and financial, right?
Yeah.
And that's the theme for that. And part of the financial thing is we have a program that we've got volunteers to start instituting attendance and working together financially towards similar goals. Now, it should have been launched by now, but our concentration, our focus on getting the holiday pass has kind of sidetracked us. But that is the key critical component that we need to reinstitute, even if it's just among the Juneteenth nation, of planting that seed. And if other people see that seed and it's cultivated appropriately, we can kickstart that back in, not just the churches, but our community. Just to kick
Steve, this is Dorsey. Make that a seminar at the conference.
Well, it will be a seminar at the conference, but in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be putting together these canvases, one in California, one in New Mexico, two in Mississippi. We're going to be putting them together and having them work, groups of 10 people, and say, y'all go ahead and figure it's a $50 a month, $100 a month, put it in together and make it work. Start there. We got to start planting the seed. So, you know, that's where we have to be. In order to make all this work, Juneteenth is the horse that will pull the cart with reparations and everything else that we need to get going. And through that, we have to be able, like I said, make everybody aware, get them educated, and then socialization. It's a three-step program, you know.
Okay.
Well, Nick
find someone to do that. Nick
said at the top of the show, where
find someone to do.
He meant that, so let's make him stay true to that. Let's see if we can't get him on one or two other shows too. Bring some other those other celebrities, get those signatures that we need to make that happen, sir.
Okay, I appreciate it, man, because we really want to get that up. Opal's out there. We're working on it. We're trying to get everything going. Every day is phone calls, calling up senators, calling up representatives, you know, and getting the needle moving. So and to get that push on a petition at Juneteenth.us, you know, support to make Juneteenth a holiday. Go to Juneteenth.us and sign the petition. and then tell everybody in your email chain to go.
Okay, so there was a that we during the part of the conversation, we did get a text in comment that we as a people have been more than sidetracked, but we have been bamboozled, which is important to, I feel, for us to remember as we remember the 400 years and why we are not socialized or why we don't work together. And, you know, we can't not forget, you know, why we're here. I mean, we did just, this is just didn't happen by happenstance, but it was all orchestrated and very well planned, as with the other people that we talk about. I've been in business and commerce since my teen years, and I mean, with the chambers of commerce throughout, you know, my lifetime, I've worked with businesses, white people, you know, coming together in boardrooms, making all these plans for our communities, which included redlining. It included, I was in the boardroom at Chambers of Commerce with entrepreneurs the Fortune 500 businesses all collaborating and working together, coming up with a strategic plan to bring Chinese businesses, the beauty supply stores, right into our communities. They organized it. It was organized. Same thing with our liquor stores in all of our black communities. These things were strategically planned. We have been bamboozled as a people. These things were planted intentionally in our communities. And so, you know, we're not working together. People need to know this. We need to know that when others come into here, you know, as immigrants, that they're handed a certain amount of money to go into our neighborhoods and take the money out of our community. This is all intentional. And how I happened to be there is because I had a skill called shorthand that I could do at 150 words a minute. I could type at 100 words a minute. So, you know, I easily was in a Whirlpool Corporation as my first job, as the first African or black woman executive secretary. So I was in these boardrooms. I was the invisible lady, because things that they talked about and planned, they didn't care about me being in the room. I'm just a little black girl, you know, enslaved girl, or once, you know, descendant of enslaved people. So they didn't care. They didn't think I was learning, but I was learning. I was listening. And so we're not here by happenstance. And it's important that we know this. It's important that we know who we are, or that self-pride is important for us to socialize so that we can come together in businesses and do bring back Wall Street, Black Wall Street. You know, we were burned out. We don't even have to talk about it. We all know all of our businesses were destroyed, 1921, 1923, when every single black business community. And that's when Salvation Army was actually created. That was the first time that we as a people didn't have our banks. They destroyed everything, all of our businesses. So they put us in line. We didn't even have homes. And then so many tens of thousands were killed, and they never bombed. They just bombed us out. So they planted that fear. They planted that fear into us as a human being, as a person. So we're not going to go back there and try to do business again. We're not going to work together again like this, because, hey, they'll come along and bomb us up again, bomb us out again and kill us.
No, that's not right. Black Wall Street was built back stronger after 1921.
Yes,
it came back
stronger.
You feel
that it was built back stronger?
Yes, it was.
It was built back. It was built back stronger without any financial help. They didn't get any insurance money, and the city did not give them any reparation. They built it back themselves.
They built it back, as a people, we are not that. We're not where we were as a people back in that time. We're not there. We're not collaborating. We're not working together.
That's part of Jim Crow. That's part of the Jim Crow effect. And as Dorsey was saying, Black Wall Street was built back. It was, they started with the other stuff. They started paving through the towns and taking the land from people. That's what destroyed the economy there. It was the insidious behavior of the government.
Urban renewal.
Okay,
and the highway system destroyed most of the black parts of town. The highway system, during the intersection of the highways and building new highways, they built them over the black part of town, which destroyed the black businesses. And then they moved the residents from those areas to other areas, urban renewal. And so they had the desire for that land. So that was a form of eminent domain where they were taking it back through laws. And
gentrification.
Right.
Still continues.
Yep.
So we got to wrap it up, everybody. It's been great. We're going to ask Michael, Dr. Cannon, Dr. Tatum, if you're on, and then we're going to ask Dr. Little, and we want our final voice to be Mr. Williams to kind of give your summary and thoughts. It's been great. I love it.
Thank you for that, Dr. Lee. So once again, I want to personally thank all of our panel guests for joining us tonight in this discussion and helping us promote a very, very productive conversation. I also want to thank all of our listeners for listening in and supporting. Dr. Lee, thank you for extending the platform for us to have these type of conversations. And thank you especially to our special guests for the night, Dr. Little and Mr. Williams, for stopping by and sharing your knowledge and your expertise with us. We certainly appreciate it. And, I definitely learned a lot and took a lot from the conversation and hope that we can have more productive and fruitful conversations and dialogues like this in the future.
Beautiful, outstanding, everybody. I appreciate every moment, every second of everybody's time. It's been great conversation, Dr. Lee. I appreciate you as well. It's been outstanding conversation. I believe Juneteenth, we really, really need to make this a landmark before the world that we did this together, y'all. Let's celebrate Juneteenth.
Yes, absolutely. And Dr. Little?
I just wish to thank everyone for the insight that you have provided to me. It's always educational, and thank you for listening to some of the small amount of information I have been able to give you. This has been very inspiring. Thank you so much.
And thank you. Thank you so very much. I certainly appreciate you joining us tonight. And you brought a lot. You brought a lot. I learned an awful lot from you. And certainly do wish to continue to talk.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Williams.
I want to thank you for bringing us on, Mr. Cannon, Dr. Tatum, Michael, and the Juneteenth Nation that's on the line. We appreciate the opportunity to move forward the cause of Juneteenth. Please have everybody go to Juneteenth.us and fill out the petition, which is the one major ask that I can have for everybody. Those of you that are in different areas, if you can call up your state representative and tell them to support H.R. 1320. I appreciate it. The National Juneteenth Observance Foundation's mission is to bring all Americans together to celebrate our common bond of freedom through the recognition, observance, education, and historic preservation of Juneteenth in America, as dictated to us by our founder, Reverend Ronald B. Myers, Sr., M.D. And that's what we're here to do. And I appreciate the opportunity to further that cause this evening.
And certainly we appreciate you, too. Thank you for joining us. It just brought just so much. I just enjoyed the conversation. And we're going to keep talking. In fact, we want to let our audience to know that tomorrow on the Dr. Mary Lee Live special, TV video show at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, that Mr. Williams will be with us again to discuss and share about and educate our community about Juneteenth. And we're looking forward to that tomorrow. You should have information about it, but if not, certainly feel free to text area code 571-251-5193, and we will send you information on joining the show, being able to see the show tomorrow. Again, I want to thank you. I want to thank our listening audience for joining us, and I love you all. Thank you, Dr. Cannon, Dr. Tatum, Michael, just for being here and being so supportive. And you inspired me. Y'all inspired me so very much, and I thank you, and I love you. God bless you, and good night until tomorrow and next week. Good night. God bless you all.
This is really
set up to kill our whole crew. Had to keep us power line, because the new
Thank you all so much. God bless you. Good night. And we appreciate you so much, Nick. Thank you.